KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. As the Chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools, Michelle Rhee implemented a variety of changes that made her a controversial figure in the education reform movement. She took the job in 2007, when D.C. had some of the lowest performing schools in the country, and she resigned in 2010. Today, she's the leader of Students First, a nonprofit that works on education reform issues, including ending teacher tenure. Her new book is called Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Rhee spoke about education at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19, 2013. The talk was moderated by Blair Taylor, Chief Community Officer of Starbucks. Taylor speaks first.
I want to get started in this conversation and just talk a little bit about your journey. You grew up in Ohio, but you made some choices to go and do this work. Can you tell us about some of the inflection points? What were some of the things that caused you to go down the pathway that you took?
Sure. So I grew up in a household that was very focused on education. My parents immigrated from Korea. They were what I termed and said in the book, a little education crazy. They were constantly telling us that our number one priority was to do well in school. And it was so clear that I tell a story in the book about how once my younger brother got a bad grade in a class, and my mother grounded me because she said that it was my responsibility as his older sister to make sure that he did well in school. That is how focused we were as a family unit on education. I grew up, my grandfather on my dad's side was a teacher and a principal. My maternal grandmother was a kindergarten principal or kindergarten teacher. Four of my aunts, my sister-in-law, my best friend, all teachers. So I've always been around teachers, and because of that focus on education that was instilled in me, when I graduated from college, I joined a program called Teach for America. And that sent me to inner city Baltimore to teach for a two-year commitment. And I literally, the experience that I had there changed my entire career trajectory, because I taught in a school that was largely seen as one of the lowest performing schools in the city, taught second and third grade, a group of kids that many people would have written off and said, well, because of the environment that they're coming from, the community, that there's no way that these kids can learn at high levels. And by, through hard work and dedication, my kids showed that it was absolutely possible. And so it wasn't just a matter of, those catchwords or phrases of all kids can learn. I actually saw these kids do this every single day. And based on that, was just convinced that what we needed to do in order to have kids be successful was create the right school environments. So that kind of set me down on my path. And after I taught for 3 years, I went to the Kennedy School of Government, got a master's in public policy with a concentration in education policy, and then started an organization called the New Teacher Project, which was a nonprofit organization that focused on bringing more high-quality teachers into inner-city and rural school districts across the nation.
So let me get right into it here, because some people would say, when the name Michelle Rhee comes up, I know your passion. I see it coming out of you now. I know your passion for young people, for children, for the betterment of young people across this country. But some people say Michelle is anti-teacher. She's against the things that have made education what it is in this country. How do you respond to that? First of all, how does that make you feel? And then second, how do you respond? What's your response to that?
You know, it's funny, the guy who was the teachers union president in D.C. when I was the chancellor there recently came to work at Students First, and after he was there for a couple of weeks, he scheduled a meeting with me. And he said this to me, I really think you need to do something about the PR going on around you. And I said, really, why? And he said, because everybody's framing you as anti-teacher. He said, now, I didn't like everything that you did, and when I didn't, I, was very public about that. He said, but you were the superintendent that quadrupled spending on professional development. You took us from the lowest paid teachers in the region to the highest paid teachers in the region. You gave every teacher a computer. You made sure that they had gift supply cards for the beginning of the year to buy whatever they needed. It's like, so how can people call you anti-teacher? And I was like, I need to send you on the road, mister. I would say this. I have an extraordinary amount of faith in the power that teachers have to literally change the life trajectories of children. And it is because I have such respect for teachers that I think we hold them to a very high standard. Some people see that, I think, as anti-teacher. I just talked to a group of teachers earlier today, and one of them said to me, I support people and unions and that sort of thing. I want to make sure that we have our protections. And they said, but we also want to make sure that we're not protecting people who shouldn't be protected, right? People who aren't good teachers, the people who don't do their job, and then we inherit their classroom of kids, that then we have to move 2 years academically instead of one. And so I feel like the debate in the sort of education reform space in this country has become very polarized into the two extremes. And I honestly think that when you look at it, there's nobody out there in those polarized places, and I think that's part of the challenge that we face.
So if you think about just the descriptions, if I can stay of Michelle Rhee for a second, I mean, you've been described as an educator, you've been described as an innovator, you've been described as an agitator. How do you describe Michelle?
He left out like the colorful
ones. I'm stopping
there.
There may be more. I'm stopping there.
It was the process of sort of becoming known in the education reform space for me was really interesting because I always looked at it very pragmatically. And so when I became the chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public schools, we were the lowest performing school district in the country. We had an achievement gap of where our white students were and where our African-American students were of 70 percentage points. If you were a ninth grader entering into high school in our city, the probability that you would graduate from college was 9%. And of all of the eighth graders in the city's schools, only 8% of them were on grade level in mathematics. That was the situation. And so for me, that was pretty much criminal in my mind that the children in the nation's capital of the best country in the world would be suffering such a fate in their schools. So I thought, okay, well, we gotta fix the system. And so I started doing things that I thought were very obvious things. You want to close down low-performing schools. You want more higher-performing schools to be available to families. You want to remove ineffective employees. You want to recognize and reward the best. You want to cut the central office bloated bureaucracy in half. And each step I took, people started saying, she's a lightning rod. She's a tyrant. She's a radical. And finally, I said, look, if bringing some common sense to a dysfunctional system makes me a radical, then I am 100% okay with that. And I think everybody needs to be a little more radical. Mm-hmm.
So you have a particularly unique view, and you talk about this in the book. When you came up, you spent a year in South Korea, mm-hmm. in the schools in South Korea. And I know you've looked at schools all across the globe. Many people, I don't think, quite understand the gaps that are emerging with respect to education in this country. Okay. What can you tell this audience about not only what you experienced in the educational system in South Korea versus the U.S. as a child, but what you've seen in your positions in the educational sector with where we are from a competitive standpoint, mm-hmm. and what it portends for the future of this country?
So just a few statistics. The children who are in school today in America will be the first generation of Americans who are less well-educated than their parents were for the first time in the history of our country. That says something about the direction that we are heading in. We are currently 14th, 17th, and 25th internationally in reading, science, and math, respectively. And a lot of people want to say, oh, actually, our education system hasn't gotten worse. We have, you know, remained about the same, which is actually true. If you look at the scale scores on international tests, the U.S. has remained pretty consistent. The problem is not the fact that it's dropped, the test scores have dropped. The problem is that other countries are catapulting ahead of us. Countries like Lithuania and Latvia, Liechtenstein, are growing academically at 2 to 3 times the rate that the U.S. is. So the more countries that leapfrog ahead of us, that has an impact on how we do overall. And one of the things that I realize that Seattle is a very liberal town, and I am a liberal Democrat myself, but sometimes this piece does not go over well. Let me just say that I believe that one of the biggest challenges that we face in this country is the fact that we have lost the American competitive spirit. Meaning, we are so busy making children feel good about themselves that we have lost sight of the taking the time that is necessary to actually make them good at things. So let me give you a really specific example. I have two kids, two girls, 14 and 10. They both play soccer. They suck at soccer because they inherited their mother's genes. But if you were to go into their rooms today, you would see trophies and medals and ribbons and plaques. I mean, if you came from another country and you came to my house, you would say, Michelle Rhee is raising the next Mia Hamm. I assure you, I am not. So I try to talk to my kids about this. You know, I sit Olivia down, baby, you are not so good at soccer. If you ever want to become good, 90 minutes every day, you got to practice, kick the ball up against the wall and in the net and run the sprints. And even if you do all that, I can't guarantee that you're going to be any good because you have my DNA. And the kid looks at me like I'm nuts. Hey, lady, like, you need me to bring the plaque to show you how good I am? Our children right now are rewarded for mediocrity, for mere participation. And you juxtapose that to what's going on in Korea. So when I was young and I went to spend a year in Korea, it was such a life-changing experience because I went into the classroom. I was one of 70 kids, and they ranked all of the kids from 1 to 70, so you knew exactly where you stood. And I was number 70 because I was the Korean as a second language kid. And if you were number 18, your parents were saying by the end of the quarter, you got to be at least 15. And if you're 8, then you want to be 6. And you would think that the only kid in the room that would be happy is kid number 1. But he was the most terrified of them all because he's looking behind. Oh, God, the number 2 got a really good grade on the test. That is how that culture operates. So we have to understand that I do not think we are doing American children any favors when we are saying, just by participating or showing up, we're going to congratulate you and tell you what a great job you did, when meanwhile, in other countries, and that's honestly, the kids in Seattle today are not going to be competing for jobs against the kids in Sacramento or in Memphis. They're going to be competing for jobs against the kids in Singapore and in China and in India. And if they have a wildly different mindset, and our kids just want to be patted on the back for showing up, we're going to be in a tremendously difficult situation in terms of our global competitiveness.
Well, what do you say to the person who says, this is a poor people problem in America? That, you know, my kid goes to suburban schools and they're doing just fine. Thank you very much. American suburban schools are educating our children and young people just the way they should. This is really a problem about poor people and poor schools, and it doesn't necessarily affect me in my life. How do you respond to that perspective?
So I feel like there's two things, and it actually angers me when people say that, because to me this is about who we are as a country and who we are as Americans. And as a nation, we have fallen towards the bottom on social mobility, which means that if you are a kid who is born into poverty in this country, the likelihood that you will ever escape poverty is slim to none. Because the likelihood is very high that you go to a failing school where you don't get the skills and knowledge that you need to be a productive member of society, you cannot get a job, etc. That's the most un-American thing imaginable. That's not what we stand for. That's not who we are. We are the country where it doesn't matter who you are, who your parents are, where you grew up. If you work hard and you do the right thing, you can live the American dream. The fact that that has shifted in this country, and now the place of your birth, the color of your skin, that's what dictates your education attainment levels and therefore your life chances and your life outcomes, that is a concern of every single person who lives in America. It's not one person's problem or another. And the second thing, just to have a little data, there was an interesting set of data that showed how kids in every country do based on income level. So you have the top quartile of kids, the bottom quartile of kids, et cetera. The bottom quartile of kids, meaning the poorest quarter of children in this country compared to the poorest quartile of kids in across the globe, they come in 23rd. Our richest kids, the top quartile kids in terms of income in America, compared to their global counterparts, 23rd. So you can't say that this is a poor inner city problem. Our wealthiest children, compared to the kids that they are going to have to compete against, are not measuring up either.
Michelle Rhee, a proponent of education reform and the author of Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Michelle Rhee in a moment, 723 KUOW 94.9. Miami Dolphins wide receiver Brian Hartline talks about his drive-through day job in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. A Harvard medical professor tells the story of how he collaborated with a Soviet cardiologist to launch a physicians' movement to prevent nuclear war, a movement that recruited 150,000 doctors around the world and, oh yes, won the Nobel Peace Prize. Hear about that tonight at 10:30. Cyprus is seeking alternatives after rejecting European bailout terms. A look at how the financial crisis in Cyprus tests Germany, the European Union, and world markets. That's tonight at midnight. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 30s. Rain and snow showers likely this evening. Mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow showers after midnight. Friday's prediction, highs around 50. Mostly cloudy, becoming partly sunny. A chance of rain and snow showers in the morning. A chance of rain showers in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows again in the 30s, mostly cloudy. Friday highs again around 50, partly sunny skies.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Michelle Rhee is a proponent of education reform and the author of Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Rhee spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19th, 2013. The talk was moderated by Blair Taylor, Chief Community Officer of Starbucks. Taylor speaks first.
So, Michelle, everything you're saying makes sense. But you go around the country and you got protesters outside. What are they protesting? What is it that you think is going on, if you had to speculate?
Well, so let me first say this, that you know, people used to protest me when I was at D.C. all the time, and, you know, if whether we were doing school closure meetings or something like that, and people would say, oh, gosh, this is, you know, isn't this terrible? And I'd say, actually, no, and this is why. I would much rather deal with anger than apathy. So if you disagree with me, at least you care about education. So then let's have a conversation about it, and you're engaged and involved. That's better than not showing up and not having an opinion and not being able to certify. Now, what I will say, though, is that the debates have become basically almost caricatures. They've become extraordinarily polarized into these places where actually nobody really is. And so you want to say, well, these people, and they're pointing at me usually, she's trying to privatize public education. I ran a public school system. I'm a public school parent. I mean, it is absolutely insane to say that I'm trying to privatize public education, because the bottom line is, when I was in D.C. running the public school system, I reversed a 41-year downward trend in enrollment. So I grew enrollment for the first time in 4 decades. So if I was trying to privatize public education, then I did a really bad job of it. That's not a relevant conversation. Or people say, oh, she's, you know, wants to evaluate teachers solely on the basis of test scores. No, I don't. What Students First, my new organization, advocates for is that we should, that 50% of a teacher's evaluation should be based on how much growth their kids see academically. The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, actually was engaged in and approved of creating a plan in Connecticut where 35% of the teacher's evaluation is based on student achievement gains. So is that what the difference is? 50 versus 35? Then let's have a conversation, a real conversation, about the 15% difference. And let's say, okay, well, let's choose 10 cities, and in here we're going to use 35, and here we're going to use 40, and here we're going to use 50, and let's see what the outcomes are. But there's no purpose in saying, you know, it's casting aspersions and saying these people are evil and that kind of stuff. It's not going to move the conversation forward.
Okay, so let's talk about moving the conversation forward. There's a parent sitting in the audience tonight. They're struggling with 2 children and what they should do as a parent in the paradigm of schools that you described that is going on across the country, including here in Seattle. What's your best advice for parents today in terms of how they should engage on behalf of their children?
Yeah. So let me first say that I meet so many parents who are so frustrated by the public school system. And I saw this in D.C., where people would come to me. And so I had a very sort of open-door policy. I gave my email out to everybody. Anybody could email at me at any time, all this sort of stuff. And so parents would email me all the time with very simple things that they wanted to know or needed for their kid. And the stories that they would tell about the rigmarole that the district would send them through just to get something so simple. It made them frustrated and just sort of like, I can't do this. I'm going to give up and move to a different district or send my kid to private school, et cetera. So we have to acknowledge the fact that there are a lot of parents out there who face a lot of frustration. But I'll tell you what I think one of the disconnects is. I was communicating with a Students First member of ours who was a parent in Southern California. And he sent me an email. He was extraordinarily frustrated because his kid, he said, look, I have a little boy. He is a handful. I will admit it myself. He is difficult. And he's had difficulty all through school. He said, but this year he has a second grade teacher who is absolutely amazing. And this kid wakes up excited to go to school every day. And he says, the problem is that this teacher, who everyone acknowledges is one of the best teachers in the school, just got her pink slip notice yesterday. She's being laid off. He said, meanwhile, there's a teacher down the hallway who's been here for a very long time, who everyone in the system knows, in the school knows, is not particularly effective. We all try to navigate our way around her to make sure that our kid doesn't end up in her classroom. Why does she get to keep her job? And we're losing one of the best teachers in the school. So I said to him, okay, so what are you going to do about it? He's like, well, I'm going to go talk to the principal and see if I can make the kid not, you know, in this classroom and not that classroom. And if I can't do that, there's a charter school opening, and I'll apply to that. And if I can't do that, then we might move or private school. And the solutions that he had were all very localized to his kid. which makes sense. But what I was trying to say to him is, if you were to spend the amount of time that you're going to spend advocating on behalf of your kids, and you were to pull together the parents in your school or your school district, and through advocacy, you should go to the legislators in your state and say, we want you to change the law so that this is not how we lay teachers off anymore. We lay them off by quality instead of seniority. You would solve the problem not just for your kid this year, but you'd solve the problem for every kid in the state for years to come. And so part of what we're trying to do is connect the dots for parents to say, there's action that you can take that will help solve the systemic problems, and you as parents and advocates have to get involved in that.
So tell us a little more about just what Students First is doing to reinforce the message that you're giving to parents. What is Students First? How would you describe it to people? And what are some of the actions explicitly that Students First is going to be taking?
Right. So at Students First, we have sort of a very simple premise to the organization, and that is that there is no shortage of highly effective and really innovative educators in this country. And there is also, we just have a very strong belief that all kids, regardless of the home environment that they may come from and the challenges that they may face, they can achieve at the highest levels if we put them in a really effective school environment. That's our premise. So what's the problem? The problem is not the educators and the problem is not the kids. In our view, the problem is that the educators and the kids are forced to operate in this bureaucracy that is driven by these antiquated rules that make absolutely no sense for kids. And we stymie their ability to actually be to serve kids well. And so the whole sort of vision around Students First is to ensure that we are creating the kind of environment where we can change the laws and policies to create a situation where those great educators can flourish and they can create more wonderful schools for kids. That's sort of the bottom line. But when it comes down to it, well, how do you put laws and policies in place? You have to lobby legislators. You have to inform the public about what's going on, try to get them mobilized around an issue, and you have to get involved electorally. You have to show politicians, the people who make the decisions, that when they make courageous decisions on behalf of kids, you're going to support them and defend them and ensure they get reelected, and that if they're not making good decisions for kids, then we're going to try to find somebody to run against you and, you know, make sure that you know that the people are sending a message that this has to be a priority.
I know there's no magic bullet. But if you could wave your wand over a school and just change one thing in a low-performing school, what would that be?
This is so hard because everybody is always asking me. I get calls from, like, governors all the time, like, I can only do one thing, Michelle. What should it be? And I'm like, you can't just do one thing. Because this is the thing that I want people to realize is that at Students First, we have a policy agenda that includes 37 different policies. If you pass any one of those, it's not really going to move the needle. You actually have to pass all 37 of them in order to create the right environment. So it's hard when you say, oh, just pick one thing. But I will tell you here's what my gut is based on the research. We know that of all of the in-school factors that exist, teacher quality is the number one factor that improves student achievement levels. In fact, there are studies now that show that if a kid in their entire public school career has just one highly effective teacher, it increases the likelihood that they graduate from high school, that they go on to college, it increases their earning potential as adults, it decreases the likelihood that they'll have a teenage pregnancy. So imagine what kids' lives would be like if they had 12 highly effective teachers in their lifetimes, in their careers. So I would believe that we as a country need to aspire to ensure that every single kid in our nation is in the classroom with a highly effective teacher every single day.
So I can't imagine anybody disagreeing with that statement. But what I can imagine is somebody disagreeing on the definition of what a great teacher is. So how do you, in the book you talk a lot about teachers that you've seen that were great teachers. Describe for us how you see a great teacher.
So one of the, I would agree that no one would say that we shouldn't aspire to ensure that there's a great teacher in front of every kid every single day. I think that the argument is less around what makes a great teacher. I mean, maybe there's some of that, but I think that the real sort of debate that's going on right now is when kids are coming from incredibly challenged environments, what is it that we can expect from teachers? That's the fundamental question and the debate that's going on today. And in that debate, there is, to me, what a very alarming thing, which is that, well, when kids are coming from poverty, there's nothing that can happen in the school or the classroom that can overcome that. I don't believe that. I know that when kids come from poverty, does it make coming to school every day and learning harder? Yes. Does it make teaching that kid more challenging? 100%. But can it be an excuse for why kids aren't learning? No. Because if we are concerned about poverty in this country, then we have to understand that if you look at any civilization in the course of history, any country, whatever you want to say, the best way to break the cycle of intergenerational poverty is through a high-quality education. So that doesn't mean that poverty doesn't matter. It does. It just also means that education plays a role in trying to change the circumstances of poverty. And it's a balance there. I'll tell a quick story.
Sure.
About sort of the power of teachers. So I went one day when I was in D.C. to visit a school. It was in one of the worst parts of town where the murder rate was extraordinarily high, you know, crime everywhere. I drove up to this particular school. Across the street from the school is a liquor store and a nightclub. As I was walking up the walk to the school, there are broken beer bottles, there are cigarette butts, there are syringes scattered all over. This is where kids walk up every day. So it was the picture of urban blight. So I walk in the school. I don't announce myself when I go into schools because then they put on the dog and pony show. So I just go down a hallway, choose a classroom, walk in. What I saw was absolutely amazing. It's this teacher, and she has the kids, 30 kids in her classroom, spellbound. And she's, you know, running around the room, enthusiastic. So this is so exciting. I'm watching. And I realized that the kids are reading a chapter book they're reading a story about a group of kids who traveled back in time, back to the time of Greek gods. And they were at the part of the story where they had their adventure, and now they were trying to go back to the future. So the teacher says, please look up at the posters on the wall, and you know, each poster had a god and what they were the god of, and she said, and tell me, if you could only choose one god to help you travel back in time, if you weren't one of these kids, which god would you choose? So the first kid raises his hand and he said, I would choose Zeus, because Zeus is the god of gods and he's the boss of everybody else, and if he tells you to do something, you have to do it. So I figure, just cut out the middleman and go straight to the big guy. I was like, that was a really good answer. Second kid raises his hand. He said, I would choose this god. It was the god of women, children, and families. She said, this is kids that we're talking about. She's the god of children. She got to take care of her peeps. So I would choose her. Another good answer. Third kid raises his hand. He said, I would choose this god. It was god of art, music, and literature. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, kid, that was a total misfire. And then the kid goes on to explain, he's like, as you'll remember from the story, the children had dug up an old Greek lyre, and they strummed the strings of the lyre, and that's how they got transported back in time. So I figured they had to go back. It has something to do with lyre, the god of music. I was like, that was really good. These kids gave six unbelievably creative answers before someone came up with my ever lame answer of the God of travel. And I thought, this is what you want to see in a classroom. Kids 100% engaged, using their critical thinking and analytical skills. I mean, it was a sight to behold. I walk into the classroom exactly across the hallway to the exact opposite scenario. So in this classroom, I open the door. I almost knock the teacher over because she's standing in the doorway. And she's screaming at the top of her lungs, "Everybody be quiet!" And she's saying, "All morning you haven't quieted down, and I keep telling you to, and you're not listening, and I don't know what's wrong with you." She said, "I'm going to count down from 10, and by the time I get to 1, you better be quiet." So then she starts going, 10, 9, 8, and she's flicking the light on and off. 7, flick, flick, flick. 6, flick, flick. I'm waiting. And you could look at the kids, they're like, "We're waiting too for something to happen." I am telling you that these two groups of children, both of which came from the same downtrodden community, both of whom were walking into the same dilapidated school building every day with rainwater leaking through the roof and ceiling tile falling on their head, were getting two wildly different educational experiences because of the adult who was in front of them every day. You cannot tell me that teachers don't matter. They absolutely do. And that is why, as a society, we have to honor and respect teachers for the fact that they have the hardest and most important job in our entire nation.
Well said. I want to get to the questions from the audience, but before I do, I want to ask you two questions about the book, okay? One, why did you write it? And two, there's a commentary in the book that's similar to the one that was in Waiting for Superman, the movie, where you talk about rubber rooms. I want you to explain to the audience just what a rubber room is and why it was so disconcerting for you when you discovered them.
So the rubber room story is an interesting one, and I was involved in it because Joel Klein, who was then the chancellor of the New York City Public Schools, was sort of locked in a difficult negotiation with the teachers union in New York around their collective bargaining agreement. And what was kind of really at the heart of their disagreement was the fact that Joel, the chancellor, wanted to make sure that principals had the right to choose which teachers taught in their building. So I want to be able to hire my own teachers, right? And that was not traditionally what had happened in the district. In the district, you could maybe choose some of your teachers, but other teachers, if they, you know, wanted to transfer into your building, they had seniority, et cetera, they were what we call force placed. You didn't have any choice. So Joel wanted to make sure that every principal had the ability to choose their own teachers. The problem was, well, what happens when teachers don't find a placement? And what Joel wanted to do was exit them from the system. But at that point, that was not sort of part of the provision. So they were going through this arbitration, and the arbitrators agreed with Joel on point one. Yes, you may ensure that every single principal can choose their teachers, but if teachers are not picked up, you may not fire them from the district. And so what ended up happening was there was a sort of pool of teachers created who didn't have job placements but were owed a job. And many of them, you know, some of them weren't looking for jobs, what have you. Some of them were people who literally had been accused of, you know, anything from incompetence to, you know, criminal negligence or whatever you want to say. And there was no way that the system could quickly move these employees out. And so they created what was affectionately known as the rubber rooms, which is where people would go. They'd get paid their $90,000 a year. They had to come in and sign in every morning. And you saw this videotape of them. Some of them were playing Sudoku and watching movies or playing cards. Some of them were sleeping. And they literally had to sit there all day long during the school day. And it cost the district about $100 million a year to employ these people who couldn't find placements in the district. And the interesting thing to me is the fact that there wasn't more public outrage about the fact that of our taxpayer dollars, $100 million a year are going to employ people that aren't working with kids. And that means that the kids and the teachers that are in the classroom every day are actually being deprived of $100 million to spend on supplies, books, what have you. So it was a really difficult sort of policy. And when it came to light, there was, you know, some talk about it, but there really wasn't the level of outrage that you would expect in a situation like that.
Michelle Rhee, a proponent of education reform and the author of Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Michelle Rhee in a moment. 847, 94.9 KUOW. As a young girl, vocalist Catherine Russell bounced on the knee of Louis Armstrong. She started her career as a backup singer for stars including Paul Simon, David Bowie, and Steely Dan. Today, she's a leading interpreter of the Great American Songbook. Catherine Russell and Michael Feinstein perform some classics, including I Cover the Waterfront and a duet of The Very Thought of You, tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. Weather outlook for tonight, lows in the 30s, rain and snow showers likely this evening, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow showers after midnight. Friday highs somewhere around 50, mostly cloudy, becoming partly sunny, a chance of rain and snow showers in the morning, a chance of rain showers in the afternoon. Singer-songwriter Leroy Bell performs some of his music and talks about his career, including the hit songs he composed in the 1970s, and his comeback on the TV singing competition The X Factor all the way up into 2011. Also, TV and radio journalist Ira Flatow tells why he thinks museums, zoos, TV shows, and films have overtaken formal education as the main ways people learn about science. And Judy Simon, a clinical dietitian and nutritionist at UW Medical Center's Roosevelt Clinic, offers suggestions for good nutrition. All three guests next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Michelle Rhee became the subject of controversy in 2007, when she served as chancellor of D.C. public schools and advocated for an end to teacher tenure. She resigned from that position in 2010 and today heads a nonprofit that works on education reform issues. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19, 2013. Next, Rhee takes questions from the audience. The first question is, how can we work with the teachers' unions to better address their concerns?
So here's what I would say. I think that it is incredibly important to acknowledge that school reform cannot happen in a real way without teachers. It just can't. Top down, superintendents, central office bureaucrats, it doesn't matter. If you don't have teachers bought in, invested, and implementing, nothing is going to happen. So we have to have teachers at the table, but we have not created an environment in this country where teachers can be meaningfully engaged in the dialogue. And I'll give you an example from when I was in D.C. We had an experience where we wanted to propose a new kind of compensation system and contract for teachers. And what we said was, we want to give teachers a choice. If you want to stay in the current system with the current pay scale, the current protections that you have, et cetera, you can choose to do so. Or you can choose a different system where while you don't have tenure and seniority, et cetera, you also have the possibility of making double the amount of money if you are a highly effective teacher. So again, nobody's forced into anything. Everybody has their choice. What do you want to do? The teachers union would not put this thing to a vote. They refused. I mean, they were like, absolutely not. People at the same school can't be on different pay scales, et cetera, et cetera. We muscled it out. We went back and forth, 2.5 years of negotiation. Finally, a slightly different plan where actually nobody had tenure in the system anymore, but everybody had the possibility of getting these huge, you know, raises and double salaries if they met certain requirements. And when we finally took that contract to a vote of the teachers, it passed 80% to 20%. So the vast majority of teachers were actually fine with the concept of accountability and, you know, that sort of, as long as they knew that there were going to be a fair and transparent process in which they were going to be evaluated. So the bottom line for me is that we have to engage more rank and file teachers in the debate. It can't, right now there's a monolithic teacher voice in this country, and it's the teachers' unions. And I talk to teachers every day, including a group of teachers that I talked to earlier, who they know the system is broken. They want to do something about it. They're scared to speak out. They don't know how to do it. They don't want to be ostracized from their, you know, fellow teachers, et cetera. And we've got to find ways to get those people engaged and what they have to say heard if we're going to move this debate forward.
Okay, very good. So another question. Given the research suggesting that charter schools intensify socioeconomic stratification through discrepant access to information and transportation, could you please elaborate on your reasons for supporting charter schools in our urban school districts?
Sure. So, first of all, let me be clear that I support effective charter schools. I think ineffective charter schools should be shut down. I support any kind of effective school as long as you're serving kids well. I don't care what sector you come from, and that's one of the things I think is important. When I said before earlier that there's this polarized debate, what you hear is the people who believe that charter schools are the end-all, be-all, the panacea, the answer to all of our woes. We should turn every school into a charter school. And then you've got the people who believe that the charter schools are the root of all evil and want to privatize. It's neither of those things. It is actually in the middle. We have some extraordinary charter schools in this country that are doing unbelievable things with kids. Kids who otherwise people would have written off. Some of the most, you know, low-income minority kids are achieving at incredibly high levels in some of the public charter schools in this country, and then you have some crappy charter schools. So you can't paint them with a broad brushstroke at all. I mean, the bottom line is that, and I always said this when I was the chancellor in D.C., you know, people said, well, you can't support charter schools because you're on this. I said, I'm on the side of kids. And if kids are getting a high-quality education in a charter school, then I'm going to support that charter school. Because it does. If you look at it from a market perspective, what's a traditional public school is, then you're drawing all these sort of false definitions and lines and whatnot. What we should care about is whether it's an effective school that is serving kids well. That's all we should be concerned about.
Give us an example. Give us an example of a charter school that's working well and why you see it working so well. Give us a concrete example.
So I will be a little biased here and talk about the charter school that my husband actually started in Sacramento. So my husband used to be a former NBA player. When he retired from the league, he went back to the community that he grew up in, Oak Park, in Sacramento, and he went back to his alma mater, his high school. And at the time, it was one of the lowest performing high schools in the entire state. It was about to be taken over by the state. It was so bad. Every day, incident reports and fights and, you know, you walk in metal detectors, et cetera. So he decided to push an effort that he would be able to turn this school into a charter school. Got a tremendous amount of pushback. I mean, unbelievable pushback. The people who opposed him spent $750,000 trying to stop his effort. $750,000 to try to preserve a school that was one of the worst schools in the state. Less than 10 years later, they took a school that was at a point where only 20% of the kids were getting accepted into a four-year college at the end of their senior year to now about 90% of the kids in that school are getting accepted into a four-year college. Same children in the same community. What changed is they took the metal detectors out. They didn't want the police there. What he was saying was, if you treat it like a jail or a zoo, then the kids are going to act like they're in a jail or a zoo. That you, if you set high expectations for kids, and I promise you this, I have seen this everywhere across the country, children will either rise or fall to the expectations that we set for them. If you are clear, if you are clear with them about what you believe they can do and you create a culture and an environment that where that is reinforced every day, these kids can absolutely be successful, and we see that in Sacramento every day.
Let's take another question from the audience. So how do you balance reform and the need for more funding? Should the former be a prerequisite for the latter?
So this is a hard one because so I travel across the country all the time. And it's what's amazing to me is how you can go to one city, and hear the same things that people are saying about funding, which is we need more money. I was in Newark, New Jersey the other day, where people were saying we need more money. They spend $22,000 per kid per year, and that does not include Mark Zuckerberg's $100 million Facebook pledge. $22,000 per year per kid. That's a wildly different situation than a Mississippi that's spending $5,000. But everybody's sort of saying, you know, we need more money. I want to share with you just some of the facts. So the bottom line is that in this country, over the last two to three decades, we have more than doubled and almost tripled the amount of money that we are spending per child on public education, and yet the results have remained pretty much stagnant. And so if I look from my own experience, D.C., which was spending almost more money per child than any jurisdiction in the nation, we had the worst results. So the idea that more money is automatically going to get you better results just didn't hold any water in D.C. And the problem was you have to look at where the dollars are going. In D.C., we had a $1 billion budget, $1 billion. And of that $1 billion, $403 million of it were going into the schools and classrooms. It means the majority of the money was going into this bloated bureaucracy of, you know, thousands of central office employees creating packets for this and that. The bottom line is that we have to know that the money is going to have the most impact when it's in the classrooms and in the schools. And so we've got to set up a dynamic where we have fiscal transparency. We know where every dollar is going. We know whether it's going to buy Italian leather chairs for the principal's office versus in the classroom for supplies. When we can see all of that, then we can, as a community, say, which things are we getting the highest return on investment for? You can take the money out of the things that are not producing results for kids, and you can pour more money into the things that are.
Michelle Rhee, a proponent of education reform and the author of Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders FC have advanced to the semifinal round of the CONCACAF Champions League, where they'll renew their rivalry with Mexico's Santos Laguna, Tuesday, April 2nd at CenturyLink Field. Ticket information is at soundersfc.com. 9 o'clock, KUOW FM 94.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.